Associate Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon. The court calls United States v. Rose. Counsel to the governor, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Lieutenant Colonel Linnell Latendra, and along with Colonel Don Christensen, we represent the United States. The Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals erred in two ways. First, by finding an impression held by appellee amounted to an affirmative misrepresentation on behalf of a civilian defense counsel. And second, by holding that appellee had satisfied his burden of proving prejudice under Strickland's high test.
Counsel, let me ask you a question, which is, it seems to me that the government is jumping in, assuming that the CCA was correct in extending Padilla, which is a deportation case, into an entirely different context. I'm wondering, is the government conceding that Padilla applies?
No, Your Honor, but what does certainly apply is how this court has looked at it under United States v. Miller.
But this case preceded United States v. Miller, that is a perspective.
Absolutely. And I think that goes to, and what this court found in Miller, is essentially what the second part of Padilla, which is that this is an unclear, not succinct body of case law. And Miller called upon and talked about the importance from 90 days prospective from that case.
Well, let me ask this a slightly different way. Is the government aware of any federal case extending Padilla to this context?
No, there was a Michigan case which is cited, but federal, no ma'am. But first,
counsel, why would, just following up on Judge Ryan's question, if Padilla dealt with the collateral consequences of immigration, why then would not collateral consequences of registering as a sex offender be in that same realm?
We can certainly, in the government, because this is a pre-Miller type of case, the government is not here to argue that it would necessarily be or not be. What Padilla did talk about is the very close, it was impossible to divorce the consequence of the conviction from the deportation. But Padilla itself had to do with a law that the court mentioned over and over was clear, was succinct, on its very face as applying to that particular appellant.
Is an affirmative misrepresentation by counsel necessary?
An affirmative misrepresentation under Padilla's context in a clear and succinct law is not necessary. However, here we are not dealing with that sort of clear and succinct law. In Padilla, on the face of the federal statute, it said, if you have a drug conviction involving more than 30 grams of marijuana, you shall be deported. That is not the case here, and there is not any sort of clear or succinct finding.
What is counsel's duty if law is not clear and succinct?
If it is not clear and succinct, then we fall back to, first, we fall back to Miller, or we 90 days past Miller, which we are not in this case. And as such, we are in a pre-Miller fall of 2005 setting, in which we then go to an affirmative misrepresentation.
Well, is affirmative misrepresentation required, or does not counsel have an ethical duty to answer the question to the best of his ability, or to tell his client that there is no clear answer, neither of which counsel did?
Well, under United States versus Strickland, first, the court clearly indulges a strong presumption that the conduct is within the wide range of reasonable professional assistance.
Well, they blowing off your client repeatedly within the acceptable range of professional conduct.
Actually, the government would request that this court go back and scrutinize Joint Appendix 98 to 101, because we believe that the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals was clearly erroneous in laying out some sort of long, drawn-out time frame in which they believe that this discussion occurred.
Well, counsel, you're not disputing the fact that the record clearly demonstrates that the defense counsel acknowledged that he was asked the question on at least two occasions. And I think what they're getting to his client?
Well, first, the debate hearing judge found as a matter of finding a fact that on at least one occasion he asked his area defense counsel, and on at least one occasion he asked his civilian defense counsel.
And the counsel, he also found that the counsel said yes, this was very important to him, and he wouldn't have pleaded guilty to these offenses if he thought he was an actor registered as a sex offender.
The debate judge made no finding of fact with respect to whether or not that was an accurate assessment. He did say that in the debate hearing. I believe he said that he would not have pled.
What did the debate judge say about the credibility of the witnesses in this case? Did he cast doubt on the credibility of any witnesses?
The debate judge found that each of the witnesses appeared to her to testify truthfully. In that, and as best as their recollection could recall, what it's careful to note what she says and what she doesn't say. She doesn't say that everything they said was truth, because there's certainly conflict between what the various witnesses at the debate hearing said. And in particular, I'd like to draw your attention to what the appellee said in response to the military judge's questioning about when was the first time that you raised this issue to your counsel. And he answered very succinctly, the first time I raised it to my area defense counsel was on the phone after the first PTA was done away with. That is one of the reasons why the government submits that the Air Force Court has clear error here, because they submitted in their findings of fact that, in fact, he had raised this issue with counsel, and that was one of the reasons that they had entered into this first pretrial agreement that was dismissed by the court.
What did the debate judge say with respect to the understanding of the appellate in this case?
The understanding, the debate judge was quite clear at first that he, the appellee, had the impression that he would not have to register. And second, the debate judge indicated that at no time was he ever told that he would not have to register. And as such, the government submits that there was no affirmative misrepresentation.
Yeah, counsel, you still have answered my question, which is, he may not have affirmatively misrepresented, but doesn't he have a duty to answer the question that his client poses to him, or to tell his client that he is unable to answer the question for whatever, because there's no clear answer or whatever, neither of which he did?
Well, he did respond to, I don't know. And it's important to look at, when was this? This occurred in one meeting. One meeting that was held 1 to 2 days prior to trial. And we find that clearly.
Let me ask the question in a different way. There's four options here. Failure to advise, inaccurate advice, misleading advice, or failure to respond. But in the government's view, do any of those apply in this case?
He certainly,
if so, which one?
The debate judge found that his question went unanswered.
So failure to respond.
Correct.
And is the government taking the view that this is not a failure to respond?
The government is taking the view that in and of itself does not rise to an...
That's a separate issue, but is the government conceding that this is a case where there is a failure to respond?
Correct. This civilian defense counsel never answered his question, and we're not arguing that is clearly wrong.
And does the government take the view that this case involves or does not involve misleading advice?
We do not believe it involved misleading advice.
And what about inaccurate advice?
It, I think, is a question that is unclear at this point, whether or not it was inaccurate. His response was, I don't know. I don't think you have to. But in terms of, it is the appellee's burden to show that he would have to register as a sex offender. And
the burden is it on this appeal if it's a certified appeal, and how does that play out?
It is still Strickland's test and response, both prongs, the burden squarely falls on the shoulders of appellee. And the review...
Appellee wanted it at the level below, and the government is taking the appeal here. So it's still your view that the appellee carries the burden?
Yes, it is.
Counsel, if the appellee establishes as a matter of law that he was required to register at some place at that time, what is the significance of the fact that he hasn't registered? That is, if he is required to register, assume that he has prejudice. Does he still have a problem because of prejudice?
I might
not even have a greater problem for having not registered and facing the consequences of that.
Well, I think the answer to that does turn to the second prong under prejudice. And the question of whether or not he has actually registered is very pertinent. First and most recently in the United States, in Missouri versus Fry, it was in the Loeffler case, the Supreme Court indicated that the accused in that case should not have, or any accused should not receive a windfall for their appeal.
I understand that, but in Fry, the windfall was different. In Fry, subsequent to the problem in the plea bargain, the Fry then went out and committed another offense. And the question there was whether that further offense would cause a problem for him. That would be the windfall if you let him win without taking that into account. Here, if he's required to register and he hasn't registered, where's the windfall when he faced the consequences of the criminal conviction that would then flow from not registering?
Well, first, it is Appley's burden to show that he has to register and query if he does.
I understand it, but the question is, assuming that he has to.
Assuming that he has to register, that still does not resolve the prejudice test. And in looking specifically at the Loeffler and Fry line of cases, as well as this court's case in Bradley, there is an objective part to this prejudice test. Putting aside whether or not he can even show that he had subjectively would have changed his plea, the question then resolves, would the end result be any different? And as this court stated in Bradley, it is not enough to show that he would subjectively have done something different. But the appellee must also satisfy... I believe that...
Is the end result the result guilt or acquitted, or is the end result the plea process, or is the end result some other thing?
Which is the point that you brought up in your concurring opinion in United States versus Bradley. And I believe there's two different parts to that. One is, would there have been a different result in whether or not a reasonable person would have pled here, objectively looking at this? And when you look objectively, you have an appellee who was facing 41 years and 6 months for crimes ranging from breaking into his next-door neighbor's house on base housing, going up into a bedroom, through a closet, through a purse to pull out four different credit cards. He was facing a litany of charges here, and no reasonable person in the appellee's shoes, this court can look to...
Counsel, now, that was the question I was going to ask. A reasonable person in appellee's shoes, after this individual had stressed several times of his concern over the possibility of registering as a sexual offender.
But this court can look to whether or not he is just making that decision, or which it was certainly a key concern. The Dubay judge found it was a key concern, this issue of sex offense registration. Correct, but it is not. It was never found to be the key concern. And we can look at Appley's own statements and actions. Specifically, in the prior oral argument, Judge Efron asked a question concerning the time frame with respect to clemency. And when was he put into jail versus when did he submit his clemency matters? It is clear if you look at Joint Appendix, page 90, line 17, that he learned about his sexual offense registration requirement the first day he entered confinement at Scott Air Force Base. His clemency petition or matters to the convening authority references over and over again how he's in confinement, how he's learned from confinement. And what does he ask the convening authority? He doesn't ask to go back on his plea.
What's the convening authority supposed to do about sex registration? It's totally outside his power.
It may be.
So why should he be harping on sex registration to the convening authority?
Well, if this court looks to United States or to the Cuoto decision and that a circuit case, which was out of the Second Circuit, they noted specifically that the accused in that matter, as soon as she found out that she was facing deportation hearings, she immediately asked to have her plea withdrawn. We have no evidence here before us that Appley, at any time, as soon as he found out, made any attempt to withdraw.
Cite a circuit case to me. You haven't answered the question. What's the convening authority supposed to do about sex offender registration?
Well, the convening authority could certainly, in his power, take a look at... He can't do anything with respect to sex offender registry. But he does have the powers, the convening authority, to do away with those charges, to withdraw, etc. There were certainly things within that convening authority's power. But there's a second part, going back to Judge Baker's question, another part of this about what difference do we have to look at. And the reasonable person, if we look at Fry, what the Supreme Court found is that the appellant must show not only that he would have accepted that particular plea, but that that plea would have still been available. Here, the appellee must show that not only would he demanded a new trial, but that he would have probably avoided the collateral consequences through that trial.
Well, I think on the end result, you're saying is he would have accepted the plea, but he's arguing that this was about whether I would have proceeded to trial and taken my chance.
I misspoke, that he would have demanded trial. But the second part of that, I see my time has expired.
Some people demand trial, whether they're even people of bad cases argue they still want members to decide their fate rather than a plea or the convening authorities of the PA. Why isn't that the end result?
And may I continue?
You may, yeah, I have the authority to grant you that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Only answer my question.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, this would go to what the majority said in Bradley, that we look at whether or not he actually would have prevailed on appeal on that particular issue. And that was a matter of whether or not the trial counsel would have been disqualified. It was that issue, not just that he would have entered an unconditional guilt or conditional guilty plea, that this court looked at with prejudice.
Knowing and voluntary plea, and he's saying it's not knowing and voluntary because I didn't know the key thing I needed to know. And you're saying disregard that, you would have lost anyway.
Yes, Your Honor.
But he's saying, no, I'm talking about whether I had a trial or not. And you say, don't worry about that trial thing. You would have lost there, too.
But the Supreme Court has stated that there has to be a proving from an objective point of view, that there would have been a fundamentally different outcome, and this court confirmed that in Bradley.
A fundamentally different outcome is the result, end result, at the very end, guilt or innocence, rather than the end result being trial or plea.
No, excuse me, the end result being with the collateral consequence that he alleges still be present.
Counsel, in this case, shouldn't he have been able to try to get a better plea agreement? And in doing that, knowing all of the facts before he decided, okay, I'm going to take a lot more time here, I've got these other offenses. And what they're interested in doing is keeping me in jail, and that's fine, I'm going to buy that. But he didn't have that information, so he wasn't able to make that determination. So we may not know.
Well, what is unique about this situation is that we do know that the government would not have accepted a PTA without those indecent acts in it.
Counsel, leaving all the ineffective assistance of counsel stuff off the table, I mean, you could respond on when you come back on rebuttal to this question, which is, leaving all that off the table, how is the plea knowing and voluntary? And the test there isn't what would have happened at the end at the very, very end. The test is, how is it knowing and voluntary if he entered into the plea believing that the facts were completely different than they were? I understand Miller gives three bases for that on the record and the pre-trial agreement, but why is it limited to that? Why can't it be extended to a situation like this where counsel fairly just completely failed to answer the question and what he called an impression and misrepresentation went into his guilty plea with a complete misunderstanding of the facts?
I'll answer him.
Okay. Okay.
Chief Judge Baker, may it please the court. Does counsel provide substandard representation when he promises his client he'll research the sex offense registration ramifications of the offense with which the client is charged, but fails to do so? Does a counsel provide substandard representation when, despite knowing that he has not performed that research, he nevertheless offers a recommendation to his client as to whether he should plead to those charges?
Counsel, in that regard, what does the record tell us about the counsel in this case? And that is, did he in the end say, I'm going to research this, we'll get back to you, or is what happened in this case that he said, I don't know the answer to this, but it doesn't matter because these are minor charges
now? No, Your Honor, the debate hearing makes clear that the accused asked multiple questions of his defense team about this. And he said that when he first asked his civilian defense counsel, he got the answer, I don't know, I'll look into it. And then he asked the defense counsel more times, and he said the defense counsel, he said in the final analysis, he said to his counsel, look, I'm putting it in your hands. Should I plead guilty? And of course, at this point, the defense team knew that whether he would have to register as a sex offender was the key issue for the accused. And his counsel said at that point, I don't see any reason why you should go ahead and take the PTA. And so in that scenario, Your Honor, there was a failure to perform the information providing function that is required by Rule 1.3 of the Rules of Professional Conduct. There was a false assurance of the kind that was at issue in Padilla, and there was a false representation, Your Honor.
Who bears the burden of demonstrate prejudice?
We do, Your Honor.
And therefore, why should we not weigh the fact that appellant has not indicated one way or the other whether he has in fact had to register as a sex offender? The brief spent a lot of time arguing about what the state of Alabama law was in 1940 or whatever, but you spend a lot of time in your brief saying, I'm not going to tell you whether the appellant has in fact had to register as a sex offender. Now, that's your right not to say that, but why shouldn't we weigh that when we're asking ourselves whether you carry the burden of proof on prejudice?
Okay, Your Honor, it's simply not in the record whether the accused is...
In an INC case, have we generally accepted affidavits after the fact related to INC cases?
Generally, I believe, Your Honor, this court has remanded to the CCA under Rule 30A in that scenario.
But can the record be supplemented in an INC case after the fact?
It could be, Your Honor, but there's several issues.
How can so supplement the record in this case to indicate whether he has in fact had to register as a sex offender?
Your Honor, there has been no such expansion of the record. But the test... Well, no, Your Honor. I mean, we have the burden. We fully accept that burden. But that is whether he ever registered as a sex offender, and whether he's required to register as a sex offender when, since June of 2010, there has been a CCA opinion that says he isn't guilty of these offenses. Whether he has ever registered, whether he has to register today, Your Honor, is not part of the prejudice analysis. And so in Hill versus Lockhart, the Supreme Court provided the prejudice analysis. It was repeated in Padilla versus Kentucky. It was repeated in...
Would you agree, what prejudice would there be if he did not have to register as a sex offender?
Well, Your Honor, I'll give you an example.
That's the whole claim here, that if I'd known I had to register as a sex offender, I
would
have pled guilty.
Yes, Your Honor, but...
Now I'm John Gilfay, he doesn't have to register as a sex offender. Where's the prejudice?
Well, let's hypothesize, Your Honor, that there are 49 states where the accused would have to register as a sex offender, and there's one where he wouldn't. He has this, and let's say that our counsel, let's say that this hypothetical accused, his city of choice to live in is Miami, Florida. That's paradise. But under Miami's sex offense registration law, because the restrictions on place of domicile are so severe, there's almost no place that somebody that has to register as a sex offender can live in Miami. So if he, instead of living in Miami, lives in some lesser city, I won't mention any as fear of offending anyone, but if he lives in some lesser city than Miami, that's a significant, and where he doesn't have to register, Your Honor.
Wait a minute, counsel. It's prejudicial in a legal sense to have to live in Pretty Prairie, Kansas, rather than Wichita, Kansas.
Your Honor, I've been to Wichita. I don't know that other city, but yes. But the answer is yes, Your Honor, because an American citizen has a liberty to live anywhere in the United States he chooses. And when that liberty has been restrained, that is a significant amount of prejudice.
So this is a where do you get to live case?
No, Your Honor, because none of this goes to the correct prejudice analysis, which again has been provided by Hill versus Locker, repeated in Padilla, repeated in Missouri versus Fry. And that prejudice analysis is, had the accused been correctly advised, would he have still pled guilty? And then Padilla and Hill versus Locker both say that there's also some objective component to that. Would it be reasonable for him to change his pleas in light of that advice?
And answering that question, does the answer have to be yes, he would have changed his plea, or is it enough to say, well, it's enough here that we don't know?
Your Honor, the standard is we have to establish there's a reasonable probability that he would have changed his pleas. And here we have far more than a reasonable probability. We have not only the accused testifying, I wouldn't have made that plea. We have the judge at the debate hearing saying, I found his testimony to be truthful and credible. Beyond that, we have his trial defense counsel, Captain Logan, saying that his understanding was that for Airman Basic Rose, whether he had to register was the key issue.
Counsel, in order for you to prevail, do we have to extend Padilla and say that being deported from this country is a severe penalty? Is that the same as having to register as a sex offender?
No, Your Honor. This.
So without reaching that issue, explain that to me.
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, there was a violation of Rule 1.4 with the failure to answer the question. And interestingly, in Missouri versus Fry, one of the key factors that the Supreme Court relied upon in finding deficient performance was a violation of Rule 1.4, Your Honor. It's a bedrock rule. So even without reaching the, is it a direct or collateral consequence or something in between, even without reaching Padilla directly, this court could say that there was deficient performance by the failure to provide an answer to the question, which would eliminate the issue of whether Miller should be revisited to say that there was an affirmative obligation to advise even before 90 days after Miller.
Is this a silence case, then, in your view?
No, Your Honor. This is a false assurance case at the very least. There were definitely false assurances.
Blowing him off.
Both, Your Honor. It was actually both, Your Honor.
I don't think so. That's a false assurance.
I don't see any reason why you should.
Yes,
Your Honor. That was a false assurance. And especially when...
I don't see any reason why, coupled with the go-ahead and sign the pre-trial agreement together, is a false assurance?
I'm sorry, Your
Honor. I don't see any reason why, coupled with that, and you should sign the PTA together, are a false assurance?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. It's the collective advice provided by... Mr. Connors. But yes, Your Honor, those are the key factors in reaching that false assurance, Your Honor.
Going back to the deal real quickly, I noted that your brief did not cite any federal cases extending the deal to this context. Are you aware of any?
Your Honor, I am not, but if I could indicate...
Other than the ones that doesn't extend, the district court cases that don't extend it, are you aware of any district court cases or circuit court cases extending... the discussion of the deal regarding the harsh penalties of the implication to registration as a sex offender?
I am not, Your Honor, but I am aware of three state cases that I'd like to mention.
I'm aware of the state cases. I'm asking you about the federal
cases. Yes, Your Honor, but if I could just, and the answer to your question, Your Honor, is no. But
I'll ask you a question again, Chris. How, if at all, does Padilla help you, and how does it help you?
Padilla provides a great deal of assistance. Again, we believe we'd win without Padilla. In fact, this case was first argued before Padilla came out. But Padilla provides a great deal of assistance. Padilla says, look, we're not going to put deportation squarely in a direct consequences versus collateral consequences box for three reasons. One, deportation is a particularly severe penalty, though not a criminal sanction. Same is true of sex offender registration, particularly in light of place of domicile restrictions. Two, deportation is intimately related to the criminal process, same with sex offender registration. Three, deportation is a nearly automatic result for certain convictions, same with sex offender registration. So we look at Padilla, Your Honor, and we see the factors that the court identified as leading to the obligation to advise as falling squarely within this case. Padilla also helps, of course, because it rejects the misinformation versus non-information dichotomy, and so Padilla is very helpful to our position, Your Honor. However, again, our position is not dependent upon Padilla because in our case, again, we have the request for information. We have the affirmative bedrock obligation of the counsel to answer that request for information, and we have the failure to do so.
Did you say the third factor was that it automatically applies or almost automatically?
Your Honor, in it's 130 Supreme Court page, Supreme Court Reporter page 1482, it refers to nearly an automatic result.
And that's how you preserve your right to live in Pretty Prairie?
Well, Your Honor, the again, it's a severe restriction on an American's liberty interest not to be able to live in the United States where one wishes. But again, that is not the prejudice analysis in this case.
How does Padilla not help you? How would you distinguish Padilla if you are arguing the other side in this case? And then how would you address the
Well, again, Padilla isn't harmful to our position, Your Honor. Again, Padilla, you know, with Padilla, Padilla is a sufficient condition for us to win, but not a necessary condition for us to win. So Padilla is helpful to us to the extent that it's distinguishable. Our case is...
What was your response to the government's argument that Padilla doesn't apply in any event because Padilla is a case about where the law is clearly succinct and obvious in those 14 things?
It's not, Your Honor. The court in Padilla itself notes that there are two different boxes of immigration consequence. There are times when it's clear, and there are times when it's fuzzy. And the majority says when it's clear, the counsel is under an obligation to provide clear advice. When it's fuzzy, the counsel is under an obligation to say to the accused, look, there's a substantial risk. And in this case, it's the United States' own position from 2005 that the consequences of this were clear. If one looks at DOD instruction 1325.7, it expressly said that when someone is released from confinement that's convicted of certain offenses, including indecent assault, that the DOD confinement facility shall notify the chief law enforcement officer of the state, the chief law enforcement officer of the locality, and the sex offender registration officials of the state that the prisoner shall be subject to registration. And when if you look at the DOD form that implements that requirement, it's DOD form 2791. It's in the joint appendix at page 206.
When was 1325
It was revised in 2003, Your Honor. I'll have to check to see when it was originally promulgated.
No, it was revised before this case.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. The version that I was just reciting, it actually was part of the 2003 revision.
Okay.
The 2003 revision refers to this DOD form 2791, Your Honor.
If Padilla wasn't out there, if it didn't exist at all, what's your best argument?
Your Honor, if Padilla didn't exist, our best argument would be under Missouri versus Frye that there was that the counsel fell below an objective level of reasonableness by failing to answer the question. And that had counsel met the objective standard of reasonableness by responding to the client's request for information, the outcome would have been different. He would not have pled guilty. By whether it is reasonably probable that the accused would have pled not guilty. And we know the answer to that question again, Your Honor. The accused actually testified that he would have pled not guilty. The military judge found that testimony to be credible. Perhaps most importantly, or most significantly, the civilian counsel himself said that had he realized that the accused would have had to register, he would not have advised the accused to plead guilty. And we can look beyond that and say that also is a reasonable approach to this case. If you look at the investigating officer's report, Major Shag, he went through the three indecent assault specifications at issue and noted problems with each one of them. In fact, with regard to specification one, he said the evidence submitted at the 32 supports the allegation, but only by a close margin. He said this specification presents a very close call on the recommendation for referral, and he said that there were problems with the credibility of the purported victim's statement.
Let me ask you the same question that I asked the government, which is, I understand that Miller has three things that need to be true for support, a failure for something to be not knowingly voluntary and not knowingly voluntarily. Is there a reason that the plea is not knowingly involuntary if it's based on facts that are other than they actually are?
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So why are you making that argument instead of the more difficult IAC argument?
Your Honor, we would be pleased for the court to rule on that basis.
which argument is stronger, and how do you overcome the language in Miller that seems to confine the facts having to be on the record, the facts having to be in the pre-trial agreement, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know where those limitations came from, but right. It seems to be set like Miller says.
Right, and Miller is distinguishable. Miller, at some point, again, it's not necessary for the resolution of this case, but if this court wished to, it may be appropriate to revisit Miller in light of Padilla versus Kentucky. There are parts of Miller that are questionable in light of Miller versus Kentucky. Again, not necessary to resolve this case. But beyond that, Your Honor, this is a different case than Miller because in Miller, there was no apparent request for information. Miller was a question of whether the counsel had a sua sponte obligation to raise this issue. Here we have the client repeatedly asking questions, repeatedly asking the defense paralegal, repeatedly asking Captain Logan, repeatedly asking Mr. Connors. And so this case is a different and far easier case than Miller because, again, this is a 1.4 Missouri versus Fry case, Your Honor.
Counsel, how do you answer the government's contention that while he was totally silent on this in his clemency submission and that therefore it can't be that important?
Yes, Your Honor. That's actually addressed to some extent in the Dubay hearing, Your Honor. The question was asked of him, why didn't you do anything during the clemency stage? And he said that when he found out about...
He was mad at his lawyer.
Yes, Your Honor, but there's something else...
He did ask for reduction in fines.
Yes, Your Honor.
He did ask. Now, had the convening authority granted what he asked, would that have affected his requirement for reduction?
No, Your Honor. No.
Would not have.
It would not have.
In
no state, because it's dependent upon.
Right now, 1325 now.
Well, not only.
The committee authority had busted the spec, busted the charge.
Oh, yes, Your Honor.
Then what would happen?
Right, right. If the indecent assault specifications had gone away.
Which is within the power of the.
Yes, Your Honor. Then the registration requirement would have gone away.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, couldn't you say that he was, by indirection, by asking the committee authority for something he could do? Attacking collaterally the requirement of
registration. Well, no, Your Honor, for several reasons. One, we know that under the Military Justice Act of 1983, in the legislative history to that, the Congress said that there's no obligation to raise legal error at the clemency stage. But beyond that, Your Honor, to get down to what the accused knew, and again, what's in the Dubay, the accused said at the Dubay hearing that he consulted with civilian counsel. After he learned that he actually would have to register. He went through his mom to consult with civilian counsel.
So he went ahead and consulted with him even though he was mad.
No, Your Honor, he's another counsel, not Mr. Connors. Not Mr. Gray. So his mom went out and found another civilian counsel to consult with. And that's significant, Your Honor, because if you asked a civilian counsel, how do you challenge this? A civilian counsel would say you raise an IAC claim through a post-conviction proceeding. And of course, in the military, we have a unitary direct appeal post-conviction proceeding. And what we know, Your Honor, what we know is that when he reached that unitary post-conviction direct appeal proceeding, he raised it with his counsel. And we know that because Captain Fredlin raised this issue gross to fine. So we know that this was not Captain Fredlin identifying this issue. This was the accused. Once he got to the stage where a reasonable counsel would tell him, this is how you raise an IAC claim, when he got to that stage, he raised it. So the government said that he never challenged this. He did, Your Honor. We know he did. He raised this issue on direct appeal, which is the place to raise this issue in the military context.
Counsel, the government and the defense have a different view of whether the record establishes that the sex registration consequences were the key concern. Does that make a difference for the defense in this case? That is your argument the same or different if the concern with respect to both confinement and with respect to sex registration, sex offender registration, are key concerns of the defendant? How do you approach that?
Your Honor, the A key concern versus the key concern is not necessary to resolve this case. The issue should be resolved for the defense in either instance. So we know that Captain Logan said that his understanding was that it was the key concern. But the debate judge found in her findings the fact that it was a key concern. In either situation, the question is, would his plea have been different had he been correctly advised? And we know it would have been, again, in part because Mr. Connors said, I wouldn't have advised him to plead guilty had he been correctly advised. And as we noted, the IO raised issues with respect to the strength of all three of the indecent assault specifications, meaning that there is a reason why a reasonable person might not have pled guilty in this scenario, because if it had gone to trial, there is reason to believe that he might have prevailed.
Could you address both Fry and Cooper very briefly, and that is, these are the two recent decisions from the Supreme Court. They've been raised by the government in this case. To what extent do those cases provide comfort for either side in the case that's now before us, or are they simply addressing something that's so off track that they shouldn't pay any attention?
Your Honor, I see my time has expired. I've got to leave it to the court to respond to the question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Frye is a very important case and supports us on both prongs of Strickland, Your Honor. So Frye on prong one, because it bases the finding of deficient performance in part on the violation of Rule 1.4, well, in our pre-Frye brief, Rule 1.4 was what we cited as saying this counsel had an obligation, bedrock obligation, to respond to the counsel's, to the client's request for information, and he failed to do so. So Frye supports the proposition that the counsel here fell below an objective standard of reasonableness. The second, and then on the prejudice prong, Frye repeats the language from Hill versus Lockhart, that the test for prejudice is there a reasonable probability that the accused would have pled not guilty had he not received deficient performance? And again, in this case, we know the answer to that question is yes. And it also is objectively reasonable for an accused in Airman Basic Rose's position to have pled not guilty in this scenario had he been correctly advised that the consequence of pleading guilty would be DOD is going to send a letter to wherever you move that says, as a matter of federal law, this person is required to register.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court will now hear from Counselor Leanne.
Chief Judge, may it please the court, my name is Sherilyn Walden, and along with Danielle Prezel, we represent the amicus counsel in this matter. Your Honors, in the two recent Supreme Court cases, one thing became very clear. With regard to effective assistance of counsel, we need to be focusing on the plea bargaining process, and that's the process that was implicated in this particular case. We'd like to present two particular points. First is that with regard to the performance prong in Strickland, this court should extend Padilla's duty to advise about deportation consequences to include a duty to advise on sex offender registration consequences, because there's a significant parallel between the severity of both of those consequences.
So why do we need to do that if the counsel violated Rule 1.4? I understand you cite a state case and you cite a law review article that cites a couple of state cases, but the federal district courts have looked at this exact same issue and found exactly the opposite.
Your Honor,
my question is, if we can resolve that saying it's ineffective assistance of counsel not to answer a question that you're asked, okay, cool. Why do you want us to go further? I mean, it's fine to be out in front of the Supreme Court and the federal court in the country, but why?
Well, Your Honor, I think in combination with this court's decision in Miller, the court has set out that sex offender registration is something that's significant, and that in conjunction with Padilla, I believe, this court has stated and is a front runner with regards to the significance of sex offender registration.
That's explicitly a prophylactic rule that this court's behest.
Yes.
Not a constitutional adjudication, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And then when we say it's something the court comprised at the time said, you know, it's something to take into consideration, it's not an effective assistance of counsel per se. I mean, because what you're asking us to do, as I understand your brief, is to say that having to register as a sex offender, which may place certain limitations on where you can live, is the same thing as being unable to live in this country at all. And it seems to me, at least, that the Supreme Court could have placed great emphasis on the line of deportation cases that had emphasized the severe penalty of deportation. We don't have that same line of Supreme Court cases in this context.
Your Honor, understandably so. I think the amicus brief takes a slightly different position than the defense in that the lower court found that the totality of the advice that was provided to Rose rose to affirmative misrepresentation of the law.
Do we have to find that? Is that necessary for IAC?
Well, Your Honor, it depends on the approach that this court decides to take. I don't.
Is it affirmative misrepresentation as the state of the law, as opposed to mumbling something to your client repeatedly? Is it affirmative misrepresentation per se IAC and the other not? What do you say?
Your Honor, I think that the standard set up in Strickland is that did the counsel's performance fall below the standard that we've established for counsel? So it's not necessary for the court to go as far as to say that affirmative misrepresentation is necessary, but I do believe that the facts
as provided by the lower court, is that the totality did come to that.
You're saying it's present. Yeah. And of course, I'm not asking that. I'm saying whether or not it's present, does it need to be?
Let me go back to Judge Running's question. Do we have to equate sex offender registration to deportation consequences in order for Burroughs to prevail?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe that it is necessary, but I do believe that there is sufficient facts in the record to support an extension of Padilla in this manner.
Can I ask you a question about your prejudice argument? The brief does a good job presenting the different theories behind prejudice and how you might approach it this way or that way. And you ask us to avoid a trial outcome prejudice test. And that seems to be the point you're hammering home. And then on page 24, then say, well, there may be many factors to take into consideration. The court should consider at least the following: the severity of the attorney error in context, the strength of the evidence against the defendant, and the strength of the potential affirmative defenses, and the probability of a different plea. It feels a little bit like the left and the right hand aren't working together here, because why doesn't factor two then become ultimately determinative? While the strength of the evidence against the defendant and the strength of the potential affirmative defenses feels a lot like a trial outcome test.
Your Honor, it's something that the court should be taking into account, but again, the trial hasn't happened, and so we don't know what, in fact, the outcome would be. So the record here establishes that not only that the defendant, Airman Basic Rose, would not have accepted the particular plea had he known about sex offender registration, but additionally, we have the civilian counsel stating explicitly, I didn't know the answer to that, and I wouldn't have...
I'm trying to ask you the theory of the law rather than the outcome of this case, because I want to define the law first before I then... case.
Absolutely.
So now let me give you apply your test, please, where there's overwhelming evidence against the defendant. There's 43 witnesses, videotape, whatever. We can, law professors can fill in the hypothetical. But this is a factor two, the strength of the evidence against the defendant. It's overwhelming. So under your test that you're positive, which is supposed to get us away from the trial outcome determinative test, why doesn't your factor two swallow the whole in my scenario?
Well, Your Honor, to the statement that you made earlier, that it's up to a defendant to choose whether or not to go to trial, and whether or not there is overwhelming evidence against the defendant, it's still within his right to choose to go to trial. The article that this particular test is adopted from advises courts to not focus too much on that particular prong because of the independent nature of a defendant choosing to go to trial or not. And then in addition to that, because a trial has not in fact happened, we don't know how it would play out in a court scenario. I think the takeaway with regard to the prejudice prong is, in light of the guidance provided in Padilla, that we should be looking at whether or not it's rational. Is it reasonable for someone in a position, had they, you know, stressed to their attorneys, it is important to me that I don't have to register as a sex offender.
Going back to what the government argued, could a rational defendant, number one, is registration of a sex offender inherently prejudicial?
I'm not sure the answer to that question, Your Honor.
Thank you. In other words, is having to live in a podo town as opposed to being a metropolis inherently prejudicial? I don't know. You don't either. Okay.
Counsel, does a plea agreement that burdens an individual's fundamental constitutional right to travel constitute prejudice?
I believe that in this case, that is part of what is being alleged as a prejudice. But in addition to that, having to register as a sex offender isn't limited to where can I live. It touches every aspect of a defendant's life: ability to get employment, ability to qualify for government benefits, and the list goes on.
You can't get through with any federal conviction for a felony. I mean, just having a felony conviction has all sorts of limits on every defendant that suffers from one.
Your Honor,
from it's going to be hard to get a job to you. You can't join the military. There are many restrictions on your right to vote.
it's important to focus on the distinctions made in Padilla as to why the court stated that deportation isn't suited to be labeled as direct or collateral consequence. Those factors are present with regards to sex offender registration.
The rational accused decides, registering as a sex offender is a real pain, and its consequences aren't pleasant. But spending 10 years in jail is even less pleasant. And I'll swap being free, even if I have to live in Pretty Prairie, for 10 years in jail.
Your Honor, that's a legitimate concern that an individual defendant has full power to make that decision. The facts of this case has established that not only was it the time of confinement important, but also sex offender registration was important. What we know is that had Rose known about sex offender registration in this matter, the outcome of this case would have been different. He would not have pled guilty in this particular case. He didn't have that information, his counsel didn't have that information, and with that information, again, looking to Padilla and the guidance laid out by Justice Stevens, there's a number of creative ways that counsel could have approached the negotiations of the pretrial agreement had that information been known.
That raises something else. The government already turned down one offer that he made, I'm not going to plead these sex offenses. I'll make give you this offer. The government said, no way. So why would the government, having already turned it down once,
Well, I think one thing to take into... Oh, I apologize, Your Honor. May I please answer the question? Thank you. With regards to that, the pretrial agreement was in exchange for a lesser sentence in confinement. And so the facts have established that if Rose had known about this particular consequence, he, as well as his counsel, could have negotiated a longer sentence to try to avoid potential sex offender registration consequence, or at least the possibility is there. Thank you. Absolutely, but I have an answer, ma'am.
Let's assume, and not saying that this is the case, but let's assume for the sake of the argument that three judges on the court are going to say, gosh, it was not acceptable for a counsel to either just not answer a question with or without the additional the additional problem of a potential false reassurance under the capital circumstances. Would the government's preference be that A, the court say registering as a sex offender is a particularly severe penalty on the same level as being deported from the United States, or the government's preference be that the case be resolved under Rule 1.4? And I'm not saying any of this is going to happen. I'm just there's been a bunch of questions along a bunch of different lines.
Absolutely, and if the government's preference would be C, none of the above. But in regard to, if we had to pick between an A and a B, I'm not sure how this court could get to either of those, because context matters. With respect to A, is registration for sex offense the same or equivalent as deportation? I would think the answer is no. Clearly, as Padilla went through and explained the severity of that consequence, the severity of sex offense registration just doesn't rise to that level, and we have no assertion before this court that it does. With respect to 1.4, is there some sort of, did he fail some sort of ethical standard here? Fail an ineffective assistance of counsel? What this court seems to be drawing upon through a number of questions is that there is some sort of repeated response to this accused, and that's not.
So you don't see that? I'm asking. So it's the government's position that even assuming that you read the record and say that one time only, someone says to this counsel, it is very important to me not to have to register for a sex offender. If I plead guilty to these offenses, am I going to have to register as a sex offender? Okay? Even if that's only asked one time, and even if it's asked less clearly than that, but the import is clearly the attorney. It's the government's position that failure to answer that question or answering it incorrectly is prevailing professional norms?
Well, the answer to that, I would look at United States versus Davis, where this court looked at a question that involved Intera, and this court looked at that the defense's sole strategy revolved around whether or not the appellant, the accused in that matter, would be able to fall under and apply for retirement under TARA. And because the whole strategy was geared toward that, the court found that the defense counsel there did have a duty to get it right. We don't have that here.
Well, we have the other findings of the debate here, that a key consideration, at a minimum, key consideration of the appellant's decision to be guilty was he wasn't going to have to register his sex crime.
Yes, and
so, unless you're arguing, I don't think that there's a case law that the court has to be the only consideration.
No.
I guess we're back to the government's position is that this was a real professional warning.
The answer to that is we have to look at the entire context of when was that question raised, how was it raised. As the Civilian Defense Counsel explained, it was raised in the 1 to 2 days prior to trial when they were talking about the second pretrial agreement, and it was raised in the context of every other question that was being raised at that time.
But counsel, you don't disagree that irrespective of whether a defendant has entered into a pretrial agreement or not, they're free to withdraw from it and plead not guilty. Up until the time of the province inquiry ending and the military deficit.
Absolutely. And even if this court were to find something under prong one, the appellant still, the athlete still hasn't proved prejudice under the second prong.
Prejudice, what is your response to the appellee's argument that it doesn't matter whether he has in fact had to register because there's some place where he would have to register?
Well, I think that the response to that is that this court answered in Miller in a prospective rule that this idea that defense counsel in a military context in particular with all of these different domiciles with unclear laws is simply not something that we're going to impose a duty upon unless the law is extremely clear.
And, the law is unclear in this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
The law is unclear generally as to whether someone is convicted of sex offense in the military has to register as a sex offender.
In October 2005, the answer to that is yes. Today, it's no.
You believe, how is 1325 unclear?
Your Honor, permission to answer. 1325 does not impose the actual duty to register.
That's right. It imposes a federal duty to register if required.
Correct.
And
the question there doesn't involve an issue of whether or not the state imposes that duty. And what is clear, and I would disagree with the appellee, that the record does make clear, because appellee on page, in the first Rose decision, appellee admitted that he hadn't fled or registered as a sex offender in 2008, and that's in the actual record of the decision.
I'm really not interested in that. I'm interested in whether the state of the law is clear and if not, why not?
The state of the law in the fall of 2005.
Where you had 1325 and you had a bunch of state statutes.
Correct.
As you used it.
Yes.
Okay.
That although DOD imposed, what DOD is saying is that the confinement facilities would notify states if the following crimes had committed by this person.
Laundry
list of crimes. And somehow, this appellee in 2008, despite that clarity, it was still not a registered sex offender.
Counsel, in Miller, did the defendant ask his attorney that he would have to register?
Yes, he did.
I don't remember more like that.
Actually, let me, I may be confusing my cases, Your Honor. Hold on.
And if that's the fact, he didn't have, isn't Miller a little...
I beg your pardon, no one advised him in Miller.
What can we take from Miller if in fact, in Miller, there was no reflection here that wasn't reflection? Do we still perform the same prejudice analysis that we did in Miller?
You do perform the same prejudice analysis, just as this court did in Tippett and Bradley, because despite affirmative misrepresentations about whether or not a conditional plea would impose the ability to raise this issue further on appeal, an affirmative misrepresentation, this court still went to look at whether or not the appeal would actually have won, and therefore would the fundamental outcome have been different, and therefore the prejudice test is still the same.
Thank you, Counsel.
The discussion that you went into with respect to context and timing, I have one question about that. The DuBay judge, if my recollection is correct, did find that the sex offender registration was a key concern.
Yes.
Are you asking us to either make a finding of fact contrary to that or to determine that the DuBay judge was erroneous, clearly erroneous, based upon the context, or may we take that finding as a basis for us considering one way or another how to decide this case?
We are not raising that there was a clearly erroneous for finding a, she repeated a twice, a key consideration, just that it was not the only one as indicated in the debate.
That answers my question, thank you.
And that's
thank you very much. We thank all the counsel cases have submitted. Context, we will stand in recess. The clerk will adjourn the court, and you all get to stand up and then sit down again. At which point, we're going to stay here and answer any questions you may have, not about the case or anything that is a fake way of trying to get it, but real questions, and we will be the judge of that. And counselor, fair game as well. This is the whole idea behind outreach things is for the civilian community and the military community to reach together and better understand the practices in both contexts. So we hope you'll ask questions of counsel as well. So with that, would you please adjourn the court?
All rise. The court stands adjourned until